From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet continues to take shape. His nominee to serve as Secretary of Defense is retired Marine General James Mattis. Joining us now is retired Army General Tom Hill, who's currently a military fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics. During his 36-year Army career, he participated in combat operations in Vietnam and in operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm. General Hill, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, let's start with Donald Trump's choice of retired Marine General James Mattis as his Secretary of Defense. Here he is testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee last year.
In the Middle East, where our influence is at its lowest point in four decades, we see a region erupting in crises. We need a new security architecture for the Mideast built on sound policy, one that permits us to take our own side in this fight.
General Hill, what do you think of this pick?
Well, I've met General Mattis, and I've got a lot of regard for General Mattis. I have a personal issue with anyone from the military being Secretary of Defense. We senior military people come at our roles in national security policy and formulation from a different perspective based upon our experience. So I have concerns about anyone taking that role from the military. Having said that, Jim Mattis is an excellent choice if you're going to do it that way.
Well, tell us more about your concerns about that. Why is it such a big problem to have somebody coming from a military background leading the Department of Defense?
Well, in my opinion, there's always been healthy friction between the senior military and our civilian bosses. A civilian boss comes from a different background. He sees security issues in a different way than a military guy does. And I think it's useful to have the civilian and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a military guy having different perspectives and different ways of looking at things. So in this case, Jim Mattis is a Marine and the chairman's a Marine. And they're going to come at national security issues based upon that experience.
Do you think that he's going to get held up in Congress because of this? We've already had at least one senator come out and say that she does not want to approve a waiver for this issue.
I don't think it'll be an issue at all. It would be an issue if it was a democratically held Congress, a Senate, but it isn't.
What about retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who would be President-elect Trump's national security advisor? What's your thought on him?
A different issue in terms of being a national security advisor. He is doesn't have to get confirmed. There's been a number of national security advisors that came out of the military. Military guys have a way of coordinating and orchestrating staffs, and that's what the national security advisor has to do. One, run his own staff at the NSC, and then secondly, coordinate the views of SecDef, Secretary of State, and CIA and other interested parties in the National Security Council. We've had some really good people have done that in the past, Colin Powell and several others who have done remarkable jobs as a national security advisor.
Based on the people that Trump is putting in place, how do you think that the U.S. foreign policy is going to change? Or what kinds of things are you looking at of how things may be different now?
I don't know the answer to that. We're going to have to wait and play out and see how that goes. It'll be interesting to see who they put in as Secretary of State, because the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, while they see eye to eye on lots of issues, there's always a give and take from those two different realms also. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
And how would you, as you look back on the Obama administration, how would you rate the way that he handled foreign policy and his team?
Well, I am a big proponent of President Obama and was from the very beginning. I have, for the most part, liked his way of doing business, his measured tones, and so I'm okay with most of the stuff he did. He could have made a couple of quicker decisions in Syria, but at the time, knowing what we know now, I'm not sure it would have come out any different.
Do you think that it was a mistake for him to back away from the red line that he put out in Syria?
It was a mistake to draw the red line.
Hmm. General Hill, you and I participated in an event recently, and one of the things that you said really stood out to me, which was that you thought that the phrase boots on the ground was not appropriate. Can you tell us more about why that is?
Yeah, I have a real issue with boots on the ground. If this country ever forgets that those boots have our sons and daughters' feet in them, we are pretty much lost as a nation. It's too easy to talk about boots on the ground when they're not attached to a human being, and human beings kill other human beings and die in the process.
And do you think that this country has gotten too disconnected from those people who are fighting in the field?
I do. I applaud the American people in their sense of saying thank you for your service, but at the same time they're saying thank you for your service, not their service. And that division will only get worse as time goes along.
Well, what can be done about that?
Well, I think we just have to continue to remind our fellow citizens that national security is played out in the lives of our people and in the lives of our enemies, and we need to always keep that in mind.
One more question, General Hill. Just since the election of Donald Trump, what's been going through your mind as you've sort of processed this, as everybody has?
Well, it's easier for a military guy to process a new president because the moment it happens, we switch allegiances because we've sworn our oath to the Constitution of the United States. So I've tried to remind everybody that he is, in fact, our president, and we need to support our president. That doesn't mean you have to buy into everything our president says, but you do need to support and work with him when you like what he's saying, and work at, you know, try to show a different path if you think there's another way of doing things.
That's retired Army General Tom Hill, a military fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. General Hill, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, thank you, Jeremy. And it's been nice talking to you again.
Well, this week, the news is, as always, filtering through social media. And there's a new platform, what Wired called Twitter for the alt-right, that umbrella group of white nationalist and climate change denying groups. The platform is Gab. It was suggested recently by the white nationalist leader Richard Spencer, who was kicked off Twitter, as was Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos for attacking comic Leslie Jones. He's also now a member of Gab. So let's start with Gab. Daniel Belton is managing editor of The Root. She joins us from New York to look at what's heating up the internet. Danielle, tell us more about Gab.
Well, Gab is a sort of a throwback to how the internet used to be, like this wild, wild west, you know, anything goes, you know, except for in the case with Gab, you know, child porn, threats of violence and terrorism. But pretty much anything can be said, and it's not really moderated. It's, you know, users kind of vote things up and down. It's basically like how Reddit, it's kind of similar to Reddit in that way, more than anything. It debuted in August. And was created by conservative Christian tech executive Andrew Torba.
Well, just a few more seconds on it, because he did this because he felt that his positions and views weren't represented in other platforms. But it feels like we're having the sort of the balkanization of social media.
Well, you know, it goes into, is it okay for someone just to say anything? And I mean, Twitter caught a lot of heat over the summer, where people were being harassed by folks who consider themselves to be white nationalists, white supremacists, who were hounding people. You mentioned the incident with Leslie Jones, where the hate speech just got really ugly and virulent, and it got to a point where it's like, how is this okay? When does this turn to stalking and harassment? When does this turn to something where you actually physically get, like, the police involved? When does Twitter actually do something about it? Well, and so Twitter did. It kicked tons of white supremacists off their platform. But, I mean, it's the internet, and people want to have these conversations. They're going to find a place to have them, and it looks like they found one in Gab.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that. But there seems to be a more civil conversation going on, at least in late-night programming. Daily host Trevor Noah had Tommy Lahren on his show Wednesday. She is the firebrand host of the conservative cable network The Blaze. As Esquire writes, rage shoots out of her like a Tommy gum. She rails at, you know, crybaby protesters. She calls the Black Lives Matter movement the Black Lives Matter More crowd. But she said on the show, I'm not a racist just because I criticize a black person.
I mean, I've never used racial slurs to address people. I've never looked down on someone because of their skin color. To me, true diversity is diversity of thought, not diversity of color. I don't see color. I go after Hillary Clinton and she is white as they come.
You don't see color. So what do you do at a traffic light? I don't believe in that at all.
Well, so what's been the reaction on social media?
Well, it's been really varied. I mean, you have those who really think this is like a step forward in this discussion for Lauren, who's kind of known for getting into these really over-the-top spats about race and about protesters, that this was a real conversation between her and Noah. But a few folks were really irritated with Noah giving her a platform. I mean, the reality is Lauren is very provocative. I mean, she called Black Lives Matter movement the new KKK.
Yeah.
Like, just basically just refusing to see the difference between a racial justice protest movement and, you know, a hate group. And so a lot of folks weren't willing to give her a lot of wiggle room. Interactive One's Jamila Lemieux actually tweeted, look what the Daily Show hath wrought, a larger platform for a white supremacist brat's doll.
Well, except it was a civil conversation, which many people applauded. Danielle Belton,
yes,
managing editor of The Root, looking at social media for us. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Fidel Castro is on his final journey across Cuba. Castro died a week ago today and was quickly cremated. For the last 2 days, his coffin has been on a 500-mile trek toward Santiago, where the ashes will be interred on Sunday. The coffin on a trailer was pulled by a Russian jeep as it pulled out of Havana's Plaza of the Revolution on Wednesday morning. NPR's Carrie Kahn is in Cuba following the procession. And Carrie, tell us first more about this journey to the funeral. What are you seeing?
What they have done in this 9 days of national mourning is they are taking a caravan across the country. It started in Havana earlier this week. It's a 4-day trek, more than 500 miles, which is retracing what was known then in 1959 as the Caravan of Victory, the victory tour that Fidel Castro took after the revolution triumphed. He went the opposite direction, west to east. We're going east to west. And right now, I'm actually in the town of Santa Clara. And this is a spot which is pretty historical in Cuban revolutionary lore. It is where Che Guevara fought a very decisive battle during the revolution. And I'm actually sitting right below a humongous tall statue of Che Guevara. And Fidel Castro's ashes spent the night here next to the mausoleum where part of Che's ashes are on one of the first days of the caravan.
Hmm. And as we've been hearing about Fidel Castro over the last several days, we've heard many people in Cuba in mourning. We've also heard people who are very happy, especially in Miami, where there's a large Cuban exile population. But what are you hearing along the journey? Is there a mix of opinions about Fidel Castro?
People have very conflicting feelings about Fidel Castro here. There's no doubt that. But during this national mourning period, I've seen a revolutionary fervor here that is clearly orchestrated by the state during this time that I have never seen in Cuba in recent memory. They've shut down everything. Schools, businesses are closed during this 9 days of mourning. And state TV and radio, which is completely controlled by the state, is just nonstop tributes, speeches, minute-by-minute, wall-to-wall coverage of this caravan. And so people have been swept up with a lot of, I believe, sincere emotion over the passing of this man who has held such sway over their lives for more than half a century. And so you really don't, especially out here in the countryside, it is hard to find people that are critical of Fidel at this moment. Yes, people are critical of the situation that is going on in Cuba, especially the economic deterioration of this country and the economic straits it's in. But right now, during this 9 days of national mourning, you don't hear that. And you hear a lot of people really criticizing the exile community in Miami for their celebrations and their crude parades and selling of trinkets and whatever against Fidel Castro. I even talked to dissidents here that were just hesitant to give their normal harsh criticism of Fidel Castro. There just seems to be a feeling that now is a time to be respectful as much as you can and to hold off on that criticism.
Now, you're making your way to Santiago, where Castro's ashes will be interred. What's the significance of Santiago?
That was the birthplace of the revolution. That's where Fidel Castro came down from the Sierra Maestra Mountains with his bearded band of revolutionary heroes and started the battles in the revolution, won a big battle there, and then came all the way westward into Havana in January of 1959. So this whole caravan is very well orchestrated by the state. It's full of symbolism. It's full of retelling that revolutionary history, reliving the ideals. Like I said, I've really never have seen such constant bombardment of revolutionary fervor that's taken over the country right now.
Now, President Obama did not send a delegation to Cuba for the funeral of Fidel Castro. What about other countries? Have they sent people, top leaders?
It's quite interesting, the list of who came and who didn't come. Leftist allies through the region, especially from Latin America and Africa, did come to a very big public rally that was held in Havana. And, you know, we heard from the old leftist guard of Latin America, Daniel Ortega from Nicaragua was there, Evo Morales from Bolivia was there, Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela, who is a large benefactor, who's Cuba's main benefactor these days, was here. And so we saw these leftist leaders and some from Africa, too. Robert Mugabe from Zimbabwe, 92 years old, came for the public rally that was held in Havana. But it was surprising. As he said, President Obama declined to send an official delegation. Canada didn't. And the big surprise was that Vladimir Putin from Russia didn't come. So, you know, Fidel Castro has been out of the world stage for 10 years. He fell gravely ill in 2006, ceded power officially to his brother Raul in 2008, and he's been out of the limelight, and it was quite interesting to see who came and who didn't, and I think the Cubans themselves were surprised at the weak attendance of world leaders that did come to Cuba for the public rallies here.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Santa Clara, Cuba. She is traveling along with Fidel Castro's ashes, which will be interred on Sunday in Santiago. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, the Bloody Mary, vodka and tomato juice, is a weekend brunch staple, and it's also become known for its garnishes, which can tower over other cocktails.
There's a Brussels sprout, there was asparagus, there's shrimp, a little hot dog.
Of course. The celery heart, which I order special and pay top dollar for, just for the looks. No one really eats the celery.
We have the lemon tomato. We have a pickle and olive. We have
you get the idea. But if you order a Bloody Mary in Wisconsin, you get something else, a beer chaser. And Elise Hensel from Here Now contributor Milwaukee Public Radio explains the phenomenon.
It's funny because we were literally just talking about this.
I met David Sage of New Berlin, Wisconsin, at Sullivan's Pub and Grill in Milwaukee. He was having brunch with his friend, Allie Borchers.
I'm from Iowa, and I've never had a beer chaser after a Bloody Mary.
Borchers says she wasn't sure how to react when she ordered a Bloody Mary and was also served a small beer.
They came out and they brought the chaser, and they're like, oh, here you go. And I said, is this normal? And he looked at me like I was crazy.
Borcher sipped just a tiny bit of the chaser, uncertain about the tradition, but Sage imbibed his.
Okay, so my argument for the chaser is, A, it has, like, it cuts a little bit of the savory down with a little bit of bitter, but B, a lot of times if somebody finds a bloody spicier, it kind of helps mellow out some of the spice.
Sobelman's owner, Dave Sobelman, agrees the flavors make a good fit. But he's not sure just why people began serving the drinks together.
Best I can come up with it, it's just a part of our culture.
Sobelman says Milwaukee is America's beer capital, and small glasses of beer have been around for decades. When he was a kid, people in neighborhood taverns nursed them.
You'd go to some of these bars on the north and south side, and there'd be men on their days off, or men who are retired. And you just sit at the corner bar. You drink your tiny glass of beer while you're sipping on it for hours while you're watching whatever, Hawaii Five-0, whatever they would watch, the Honeymooners.
Put a little bit of Guinness in it to make it a little, like, smoother, creamier. Okay.
Sobelman guesses at some point someone realized a small glass of beer would go nicely with a Bloody Mary. Matt Langer shared his thoughts on the chaser's origin while preparing a Bloody Mary at Milwaukee's historic White House Tavern.
It's always got to be shaken.
Langer says for years, barroom customers have ordered a shot and a beer, using the beer to chase the liquor.
It's kind of like the water back when you order something neat or on the rocks, like a bourbon. Even a lot of a younger generation doesn't understand that it's standard to hand a small side of water with it, too, just to kind of, you know, wash the burn down.
Solanger says when the Bloody Mary arrived on the scene, it must have occurred to someone that beer would do a good job chasing the thick, spicy drink. Historian Jim Drager confirms chasers were established before the 1950s when Bloody Marys began to catch on in the Midwest. Drager is co-author of Bottoms Up, a toast to Wisconsin's historic bars and breweries.
You can certainly find chasers in Minnesota, parts of Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, but kind of the heart of the chaser is in Wisconsin.
And do you have any sense of why that is?
Tradition and custom, I would say, would be the answer to that. You know, some things are just because they are.
Drager says while chasers in general are regional, he believes the Bloody Mary chaser is most often found in Wisconsin. But you'll also see them served next door in Minnesota, where the chasers are called a snit. Snit is a mixology term referring to 3 ounces of liquid. Yet while the beer chaser is well-loved among fans, Drager believes the tradition is dying out.
The Bloody Mary itself is getting more ambitious and more decorated as well. You know, the garnish are becoming a lot more elaborate, and there's a lot more attention paid to the garnish. So in some ways, the garnish is starting to replace the chaser, I think.
As far as beer lovers such as Chris Ranson are concerned, what matters is not the prevalence of the chaser, but rather its quality. She's with Lakefront Brewery in Milwaukee.
The beer should accent that Bloody Mary flavor, and if you have something that doesn't do that, then might as well not have it.
Ranson offers this suggestion. A good complement to a Bloody Mary is a beer that's balanced, hoppy, and malty. She says try an amber lager. For Here and Now, I'm Annalise Henzel in Milwaukee.
The unemployment rate in the U.S. has hit a 9-year low. The Labor Department reported today that the jobless rate dropped to 4.6% last month, and employers added 178,000 jobs. Michael Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the unemployment rate fell from 4.9% in October to 4.6% last month. What's behind the drop?
Well, part of it is obviously the steady trend of jobs growth naturally has an effect on the unemployment rate over time. But a big reason this month was actually a drop in the labor force participation rate, which is basically the share of working age people actively in the labor force. It dipped by just 0.1% to 62.7%. But it's a very important input. So even a small drop like that can have a very noticeable effect.
Which sectors in the economy gained ground last month?
Well, one of the big gainers was business services, things like bookkeeping, accounting jobs. Healthcare added 28,000 jobs. That was another bright spot. The down spots were manufacturing and retail sectors actually lost jobs.
And hourly wages actually went down last month. What happened there? And where are we overall with wage growth this year?
Yeah, wages were down 0.1% compared with October. They're up about 2.5% year over year. Our economists here pointed out that it's very likely a result of a surge in earnings in October due to the large amount of utility workers who were paid overtime to clean up after Hurricane Matthew. So it may be a bit of an anomaly.
Have we reached full employment if we're at 4.6% unemployment?
That is the eternal debate. It certainly appears to many like we're either there or very close. But some of the things we've just talked about, the lagging participation rate and wage growth that doesn't really show signs of heating up too much, lead some people to believe that there is still a little bit of slack in the labor force.
And what about the Fed? All eyes now turning to December. They're having a meeting this month to decide whether to raise interest rates.
Yeah, so these numbers basically reinforce this notion that a quarter percentage point increase in the Fed funds rate at the December 14th meeting is all but guaranteed. And if these current trends persist, we'll probably be looking at another two or three interest rates next year, too.
By the way, are we still in recovery right now? Are we still technically recovering from the financial crisis and the recession if the unemployment rate continues to go down? Because it was up around 10% back at the start of that.
I would, you know, I think that's a judgment call. I would say we're pretty much recovered. I would think so. You know, I'm sure a lot of people out there will argue with me about that, though.
And actually, another thing I want to ask you about this jobs report, Mike, is what happened with white men? Because I know that the number of people in the labor force that dropped was concentrated there.
Yeah, that number did tick down. White men over the age of 20, the participation rate was down 0.2% to 71.7%. Many of the other demographic groups were steady or higher. But in general, the participation rate has been trending lower since the turn of the century, really. And there's a lot of reasons. Demographics, you know, we have the big baby boom population where some might be retiring earlier. You also have this big millennial population. And both ends of the spectrum tend to have lower participation rates.
That's Michael Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, talking with us about the jobs report today. The unemployment rate dropping to the lowest level in 9 years. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
Europe is watching Sunday's election in Austria as a barometer of the power of the far right. Norbert Hofer of the Anti-Immigration Freedom Party is the far right candidate. His opponent is Alexander van der Bellen, a left-leaning independent. Joining us now, the BBC's Bethany Bell. She's in Vienna. And Bethany, there was a big debate last night. We'll get to that. But tell us, who are these candidates and what are the cases they're making to voters there in Austria?
Well, these two people are running for the position of head of state, which is basically just a ceremonial position, although it does have the power to dismiss the government. Norbert Hofer is from the far-right Freedom Party, which has campaigned on a Eurosceptic platform. They don't like the EU very much. They don't like immigrants. They've said a lot of things against Muslims. They have also, it's a party that was founded after the Second World War by a group of ex-Nazis. So in the past, it's often been seen as having kind of a core of neo-Nazi ideology, which Norbert Hofer, this current candidate, has really tried to stop. And he's presented himself as the smooth, soft face of this party.
Well, of course, Hitler was born in Austria, so that would resonate there. But tell us about his opponent.
He's the former leader of the Green Party in Austria. He's very pro-Europe, pro-immigration, kind of wants Austria, he says, to be cosmopolitan and open-minded, and wants very much to stay in the EU, and has also condemned, you know, aspects of the far-right Freedom Party. So you couldn't get more opposed candidates, if you liked.
Well, does Hofer, whose agenda seems to be something like Donald Trump's anti-immigration, perhaps banning Muslims, does he refer to Donald Trump's victory?
Well, it's interesting. I spoke to him a little while ago and I said, is the victory of Donald Trump in the States going to help you at the ballot box? And he said, you know, no, well, people in Austria will vote because of Austrian reasons. But he did kind of also suggest that maybe the sense of the wave of possibility for victory for populist politics may help him. And I think certainly people will be watching this election very clearly to see, you know, just how strong this wave of populism can be, because it's not just about this particular election. There are, you know, other elections going on throughout Europe. So really, I think it's people trying to see just how strong the populist politics are.
Yeah. We just want to ask you about something that caught our eye. Slurs directed at both candidates, both the Freedom Party candidate. You mentioned that Hofer's party was founded years ago by Nazis, and he's tried to distance himself from that. But slurs also against the left-leaning independent, Alexander van der Bellen, using Nazi insignias. What's going on here?
It's been a very complicated and long election campaign. Traditionally, the supporters of Alexander van der Bellen have criticized the Freedom Party for having its roots in Nazism, something that Mr. Hofer very much denies. And that's been a real part of this election campaign. We've seen videos with Holocaust survivors warning against the dangers of that era. Those people on the side of Mr. van der Bellen. Then, a little while ago, the tables kind of seemed to be turned when a Freedom Party politician accused Mr. van der Bellen's father of having been a Nazi. That's something Mr. van der Bellen denies. And in fact, there was an interesting stormy debate last night on television where the two were basically shouting liar, liar at each other, or lies, lies. So, you know, a very kind of it's clear that whatever the truth or non-truth behind these accusations are, the shadow of Austria's past is something that has really hung over this election.
No, but you caution that this is also a red herring, that this is largely members of Hofer's Freedom Party sort of turning the tables on the other party and making the accusations themselves.
That's right. I mean, I think this is an election which, you know, is being seen as a victory for populism, a party with an unpleasant history. But, you know, I don't think that people are imagining that, you know, an openly either openly Nazi politicians are about to take power in Austria.
The BBC's Bethany Bell in Vienna. Bethany, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Between that and the referendum in Italy this weekend, lots to watch in Europe. Well, here in this country, police departments around the country are continuing to feel pressure from community activists and civil rights groups to bolster transparency in the wake of police shootings. In Pennsylvania, a controversial bill that was passed by the legislature would have made the public wait before knowing the name of a police officer who fires a weapon in the line of duty. The measure was vetoed by the state's Democratic governor. Advocates for more police accountability consider the veto a big win, but law enforcement groups say the governor's decision could endanger officers' lives. Bobby Allen from Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
In his veto memo, Governor Tom Wolf said when police fire their weapons, the public has a right to know as much as possible. Otherwise, he wrote, a harmful mistrust will grow between police officers and communities. But Pennsylvania House Republican spokesman Steve Miskin says Wolf's veto is really bad news for police.
When a bill passes with such strong bipartisan support and overwhelming majorities, it's always a little bit surprising and shocking when a governor vetoes a bill like this.
The bill would have kept secret for 30 days the names of officers who shoot at civilians.
This just gives them a little peace of mind as they protect the public that a fair and objective investigation can be conducted and that doesn't put them or their families at risk.
The argument goes, if a police officer is named soon after a shooting, many will assume the cop is in the wrong. That could even make someone want to seek retribution. When the bill was introduced, proponents were asked to point to examples of such payback, but they didn't have any. Opponents often mention that, while also saying that the bigger risk here is community perception. If it looks like cops are hiding things, the public will respond. Kelvin Anderson is the executive director of the Philadelphia Police Advisory Commission.
If people believe that we are actually going backwards and we are not going to make good on the promise of transparency, I think that that will potentially inflame communities even more in these circumstances.
Former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey held the same view. Under his leadership, the department started releasing within 72 hours the name of an officer who fires while in the line of duty. The Department of Justice recommended the step to help make police in Philly more accountable in the wake of a noticeable spike in officer-involved shootings in 2012. The bill that Wolf vetoed was trying to pump the brakes on Ramsey's policy. Those who agreed with the governor's veto included Democratic Representative Jordan Harris of Philadelphia. He says, take for instance a mother grieving after her son was fatally shot by police.
And now we are going to bar chiefs of police across this Commonwealth from providing that mother with a name, providing that mother with the thought that the process will not be tainted, that the process will not be rigged against her and her child.
Harris says the best disinfectant is sunlight.
This closes the window. This pulls down the shade. This doesn't let the sunlight in. This keeps communities in darkness. And when communities are in darkness, you see unrest.
The union president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 5 in Philly, expressed disappointment that the governor vetoed the bill. John McNesby said Wolf showed disregard for police by, quote, spinelessly caving to the howling mob of anti-police hate groups. And Representative Martina White of Northeast Philly has vowed to reintroduce her legislation next session.
I understand where people are coming from in terms of, you know, wanting to hold our law enforcement accountable, and I completely agree with that. But I think there's also a balance to that.
Withholding the officer's name for 30 days, she says, will allow the investigation to take place and facts to come forward internally.
Instead of this rush to judgment that really doesn't do the public or even the law enforcement officers or their families any justice.
The governor's veto is a win for now for police reform advocates, but the larger battle is on hold until the legislature reconvenes next year, when Republicans will have larger majorities following this year's election. If it becomes law next year, Pennsylvania would be the only state to restrict releasing an officer's name in the wake of a shooting. For Here and Now, I'm Bobby Allen in Philadelphia.
Several companies, Kellogg's, Allstate, the pharmaceutical giant Novo Nordisk, the eyeglass retailer Warby Parker, and the San Diego Zoo, have pulled their advertising from Breitbart, the platform seen as anti-Semitic, white supremacist, climate change denying, anti-feminism, anti-PC. It was led by Steve Bannon, who's now Donald Trump's chief strategist. The companies had no idea they were advertising on the site in the first place because of something called programmatic advertising, and now there's a backlash against some of them for pulling out. Here now, media analyst John Carroll is here. John, start with that programmatic advertising. What is that?
It's the new wave of ad buying. It helps to go back and look at traditional media buying. Media buyers would look at media outlets. They would come up with a strategy, and then they would go to negotiate with those media outlets for prices for the ads that would run on them. There are over a billion websites out there, and so there's no way that that system can work anymore. So programmatic ad buying is basically buying by software algorithm, and it spreads ads out all over the internet. So in many cases, the advertisers don't know where their ads are running.
Well, and how did companies find out they were on Breitbart?
Well, this is a particular campaign by a group called Sleeping Giants. They have a Twitter account, and it's sort of a crowdsourced monitoring group. And what they do is they have all kinds of people, they have about 8,000 followers, taking screenshots of Breitbart News website and with ads, and then tweeting them to the advertiser and saying, do you know you're on this website?
Right.
And do you want to be on this website? Well, and it's led a number of them to pull their ads.
Because the spotlight was on. Look, a reporter for the tech website DigiDay looked at a dozen sites it identified as alt-right and found on these websites ads served by Google for major national brands, including American Express, Sprint, Walgreens. Now, some of those advertisers might want to be on those sites. Readers are consumers as well. But these are also likely to be programmatic issues. I mean, are companies going to have to start doing monitoring of their own?
I think they do a certain amount of monitoring, and a number of them will say, we don't want to be on these kinds of sites. And so the software algorithm will be adjusted for that. But I think this is really dangerous territory, because who determines what a website is and who determines which websites are acceptable or not? You're right. Conservatives have money, and they spend it, and they spend more than liberals sometimes. So, so there are legitimate reasons to advertise on conservative websites. The problem is that once they're demonized and marginalized by these sort of crowdsource groups, then they have a difficult time actually doing business, and it might be unfair. There might be some websites targeted that should not be targeted. They're legitimate conservative opinion websites.
I was going to say, let's make a distinction between conservative and alt-right, which is self-described in many ways as white nationalist, as supremacist, as racist, as anti-feminist, as, you know, there's a whole genre of young white men who just see themselves as boosting their tribe, you know, that falls under the white nationalistic. But it's very different from just saying a conservative website.
Right, like a Fox News website, for instance. But also, to be fair, balance, Breitbart News says we're not any of those things, that we're upholding traditional American values. And so it's the people who are bigoted are the people who are protesting us. They're the ones who are un-American.
Although Bannon, Steve Bannon, has said he was a platform, Breitbart was a platform for the alt-right. So,
it all depends on how you define alt-right.
Well, you know what? Read it and, you know, decide for yourself what it is. But what's been Breitbart's response?
Well, Kellogg has been one of the major advertisers that's pulled out and been a high-profile one. So they have started a boycott of Kellogg. They have a hashtag dump Kellogg on Twitter. And they're calling Kellogg bigoted and un-American. They say if you serve Kellogg breakfast cereal, you're serving bigotry to your family in the morning. Mm-hmm. That's kind of PR jujitsu in many ways to level that claim at Kellogg. But but they're saying that it's having an effect on a number of their readers, and they seem to have about 20 million monthly viewers. A number of their readers are responding to their call for a boycott.
Huh. Jeremy's going to jump in here.
John, I just want to ask you while we're talking to you about advertising, whether after this campaign in which Donald Trump spent very little money comparatively on ads, whether ads in the political world are going to be very different next time around and not as important.
It's very possible. Hillary Clinton outspent Donald Trump about 3-1 in the end on in television ads, and they didn't seem to do very much good for Hillary Clinton. The strategic money that Donald Trump spent at the end of the campaign seemed to do him some good, but a lot had to do, I think, with what he was talking about. I'm not sure that anybody else could run the campaign that Donald Trump ran. I don't see Mitt Romney running that campaign.
Yeah, I was going to say it could happen again next time if Donald Trump is running again next time.
Right. but I think what we did see is a migration of a lot of marketing dollars in the political arena to the digital platforms. And I think we're going to see that increasingly as we go along.
Well, back to these algorithms and Breitbart, John. Are you seeing more companies and businesses pulling ads from these self-proclaimed alt-right sites?
Yeah, well, we are. They claim that about 6 have pulled. I just looked at their website, the Twitter account, and the ones that were mentioned in the last couple of hours, Dr. Pepper, Southwest, a whole bunch of people. So I think it's going to continue.
John Carroll, professor of mass communication at BU and a veteran of the advertising world. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.